Halsey Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan.
Events which have transpired during the past few hours are of startling dramatic significance to the entire world. Certainly they point towards war, economic war and crimson, lurid military war. The Republic of Czechoslovakia has been dismembered. Hungary has reached out to assimilate Ruthenia. The German Chancellor is on his march to the east, to the oil fields of Romania, to the wheatlands of the Ukraine. The last subterfuge of democracy has been shelved in France. Pelletier has been vested with the indefinable powers of a dictator. At home, our government executives have declared economic war against Germany. Our papers carry the startling news of an official announcement made by our government executives, through virtue of tremendous powers vested in them by Congress, that a 25% penalty tariff on goods coming from Germany is now the order of the day. These are sanctions. These sanctions mean economic war. They are the modern method of instituting an undeclared war. Moreover, an Associated Press dispatch appearing today in metropolitan newspapers declares that the General Jewish Council, after a period of 6 years of indefatigable effort, has achieved the boycott against Germany for which it had been working. Still, withal, no boycott is discussed in the matter of Russia. All these percussions and repercussions originate from the powder keg of the so-called peace treaty of Versailles. The injustices legislated in 1918 have exploded upon the world in 1939. The Munich Pact, which gave promise of peace a few months ago, has melted in the fires of passion because the peace which it molded was fashioned from the wax of hypocrisy. There can be no peace without economic peace. On every side, questions are rife. Whither are we going? What of our future? What is the story behind the story? What of the Neutrality Act? What of war? Social Justice Magazine, in its next week's issue, will discuss these questions thoroughly, fearlessly, and factually. The internationalistic disturbers of the world, long busy in their laboratories of destruction, are mixing the chemicals of propaganda in the mortar of secrecy. Most effectively, they use the pestle of intrigue, of hate, and of lust for power. This compound must be counteracted. Last week, according to the daily newspapers, a little lad, 10 years old, was selling social justice on the subway trains of New York City. He was assaulted by a man named Silver, who was arrested. He and his type are also active. I speak these things to you as a challenge on behalf of Social Justice Magazine to invite 5,000 more fearless, responsible persons to volunteer to distribute this news weekly, which is determined to play its part in counteracting the warmongers and in keeping America free from foreign entanglements as the events of the past week move us nearer and nearer to the brink of crisis. Social Justice Magazine is of the opinion that if the international disturbers, the warmongers, and the type of persons such as they who intimidate the distributors of Social Justice Magazine are not challenged at this time, both liberty and peace will vanish from our earth, and so will our doctrine of no foreign entanglements. Read of all these things in next week's Social Justice Magazine. This afternoon, Father Coughlin will discuss a very factual subject, which he entitles Social and Economic Reforms. Write to Father Coughlin directly at Royal Oak, Michigan, to arrange for your weekly copy of Social Justice or to volunteer to become a responsible distributor. Copies of this address to which you are about to listen will be gladly mailed to all those who request it. And now, Father Coughlin.
Good afternoon, my friends. All winter long, the priests at the Shrine of the Little Flower literally have been immersed in the tears and sorrows of suffering humanity. I doubt if our 10-year-old depression produced more pain and grief and distress than was witnessed this past winter. We have seen, as have many other pastors and social workers, a gradual, constant increase inhuman casualties. Families which in former years managed barely to escape the ravages of poverty finally succumbed. How long must this continue in this land of wealth and plenty? In this land of kindliness and splendid ability? Coming in such constant contact with this ever-pressing problem of social distress, I am more convinced now than at any other time of the necessity for sound social reform. I am more persuaded in 1939 than I was in 1929 of the necessity to abandon any economic traditions which obstruct their fulfillment. During 1938, there were 22 million persons on relief. One out of every 5.5 persons in our nation. These families on relief were not living on the other side of the railroad track. We have discovered them in our residential districts, in every neighborhood. Oh, they are pitiful cases. Could you feed a family of four where the father receives $1.69, the mother and two children under 10 years of age, $1.39 each, a total of $5.79 each week for relief? It can't be done. It can't go on. This social sin must be abandoned by America. However, this is not the time for lamentation. These are days when calmly, righteously, and fearlessly, the decent element of American people is planning to act, not for the destruction of American institutions, but for the construction of a more equitable and humane plan of producing and distributing our wealth. There is a sufficient number of us who are so well informed that we refuse to accept the it can't be done philosophy of the reactionaries who are still content to adore the false god of rugged individualism and his gospel of modern capitalism. Oh, the mills of justice and information grind slowly. We know that only within recent weeks the government's report on American incomes for the fiscal year of 1935 and 6 found publication in an obscure corner of the New York Times. We know that of the 39 million Americans who filed tax reports that year, 10,390,000 families reported incomes of less than $750 for the year. Ponder what that means. Nearly one-third of all American families buying food, paying rent, begging second-hand clothing, and seeking medical care as they struggle to keep body and soul together on $750 for 365 days to be divided among 5.5 persons. Even more startling is the revelation that 22 million families, not persons, representing nearly 60% of our population, were supported on incomes of less than $1,250 a year. Oh, where is the world-famed American standard of living, which is represented by a national family average income of $1,050 a year? Where are the arguments of the proponents of modern capitalism when faced with this fact, a fact which cannot long endure without its repercussions crackling under the dome of the Capitol at Washington? I have a thesis to present to you today. It is this. Social reforms are absolutely necessary, but they cannot be attained unless they are preceded by or accompanied with economic reforms. In plainer language, we have an abundance of vast resources. We have 130 million mouths to feed and bodies to clothe and shelter. We have plenty for all and plenty of skilled hands and trained minds with which to produce it. But the artificial barrier erected between production and consumption, which we call capitalistic economics, must be broken down to permit the waters of this plentiful production to flow unimpeded to these 130 million citizens. Starvation, deprivation, and man-made depressions, contingent upon a man-made devisal of political economy, must either retire gracefully or be forced to retreat into oblivion. A new economy, which can be no more detrimental than the old at least, will be inaugurated. I advance this opinion when challenged with a statement made last week by the Federal Reserve Board, a government institution established to supervise the non-government, privately owned institution known as the Federal Reserve Bank. The statement of the board members reads as follows, quotation, "In view of all these causes, the board does not favor the enactment of any bill based on the assumption that the Federal Reserve System or any other agency of the government can control the volume of money and credit and thereby raise the price level to its prescribed point and maintain it there," unquote. These words are equivalent to this: we cannot control prosperity or depression. We cannot do anything about poverty or distress. We cannot enact any legislation to permit production meeting the demands of consumption. We are Marie Antoinette's who piously tell the people of the United States that if they have no bread, let them eat cake. Let us not depart from our thesis. Social reforms are positively required and absolutely supported by the majority of clean-minded Christian Americans. But since every child is aware that in our complex life we cannot obtain clothing or food or shelter without money, and since money is the accepted means through which the necessities of life are obtained, shall we Americans complacently accept this Olympian pronouncement from the officers of the Federal Reserve Board as final, and therefore, in the spirit of predestination, patiently accept the sufferings which are multiplying around us? Must we abandon all hope for sound social reform because these theologians of the God of Gold inform us that from the hell of depression there is no redemption? As early as 1932, it was my privilege to point out the need for our federal government interesting itself in necessary public works, and particularly in slum clearances. It is my contention that the federal government should interest itself both in planning and executing necessary public works such as reforestation, flood relief, the electrification of highways, the development of water power, and the clearance of slums. My suggestion did not encompass the thought that the government should compete with private industry. However, in times when the labor market is surfeited and when private industry cannot engage the services of workmen, I propose that these public works should be undertaken by the government through the agency of private contractors in order to give employment at not less than living wages, and in order to enable the government to issue, through those thus employed, a sufficiency of tax-free purchasing power. Above all, I never advocated that the government should borrow money from the privately owned institution known as the Federal Reserve Bank to finance these necessary projects, because such money is not tax-free. It is money which these institutions create 10 and 20 times above what they actually possess. It is money which eventually is represented in tax-exempt bonds, which the rich corporations and individuals of the nation purchase. It is money which multiplies depressions instead of removing them. Experience has proven that if rich corporations and individuals invest in bonds issued by the government to the privately owned Federal Reserve Bank, capital is actually investing in depression and debt, not in progress and in production. On the other hand, money issued directly by the government against the wealth of the nation is tax-free at its very origin. It is negotiable and therefore can be transferred from citizen to citizen. And thus, it permits rich corporations and individuals to invest their capital not in debt, but in production. Moreover, it has been my constant opinion since 1932 that whenever the purchasing power of the country is normalized, men who are working on government projects can then find re-employment in private industry where wages should be higher and where they can work not only at a living wage, but at a profitable wage. I am glad to give re-expression to these thoughts today because they are concerned with economics, with living wages, with finances, without which the social evils of poverty and slums cannot be abolished. With this preliminary remark, let us turn our attention to the United States Housing Authority, which came into existence in the year 1937 as a result of the United States Housing Act. It was established, as the legislative document says, quotations, to provide financial assistance to the United States and political subdivisions thereof for the elimination of unsafe and unsanitary housing conditions, for the eradication of slums, for the provision of decent, safe, and sanitary dwellings for families of low income, and for the reduction of unemployment and the stimulation of business activity, unquote. Observe, my friends, carefully the words, that it was authorized to provide financial assistance to attain these objectives. Consequently, unless the finances are sound, the objectives will fail. Here, then, is a definite objective of social reform, namely, the slum clearance.
and the adequate housing facility. Here is an effort being made to bring about this objective under the same economic system which prevailed in the heyday of rugged, ragged, individualistic capitalism. Here is a concrete attempt on the part of government to clear slums and build houses for the unfortunate one-third of our fellow citizens by using the obsolete method of capitalistic bond issue. Let us find out how it operates. Let us analyze its future prospects from official facts now available. And we will discover that if we retain the private issuance and control of money, that if two-thirds of our citizens who are gainfully employed suffer an ever-increasing rise in taxation to liquidate these bonds and their interests for the one-third living beneath the standard of American living, and that if capital invests in debt instead of production, our social reforms will not operate. In fact, they will force those citizens now living in the twilight between the sunshine of prosperity and the darkness of distress, they will force them to suffer added financial burdens through taxation and thereby to enlist themselves with those who already have succumbed before the onslaught of capitalistic economy. Carefully analyzing the law which created the United States Housing Authority, Congress, in effect, said this: we authorize the United States Housing Authority to clean out the slums in the big cities of our nation, to build in their places safe, sanitary, and substantial homes. We go on record for this social reform, but we also go on record to maintain intact the economic financial abuses of capitalism, which in the first place built these slums, and which do not permit the residents in these hovels to earn a decent livelihood. In the 18 months since the Housing Act became effective, our government has been engaged in slum clearance. From its latest report, an official document whose figures cannot be contradicted and issued on December 22, 1938, we can trace accurately and judge clearly how this well-designed social reform has been and will continue to be a menace, a veritable menace, because it was not accompanied or preceded by an economic reform. At this juncture, I quote for you Senator Tidings of Maryland, who says, as I see it, as the act is now written and as it is now being administered, the government of the United States of America has launched upon the greatest scheme of state socialism it has ever entered into. It seems to me to be on the Russian model. While undoubtedly accomplishing some of the objectives set forth in the Act, it is creating disadvantages and burdens for the remaining poorly housed people of the nation to an extent almost unbelievable. Do the people of America know, continues he, that the families now living in the slums or in unsafe and unsanitary houses are to be rehoused in new, modern, high-priced apartment buildings which cost more per family unit than the average house of the average American family? Do the people of America know that a part of the rent of those who will live in these government-financed houses, which supplant slums, is to be paid by the government of the United States under contract for a period of 60 years? in the future. And do the people of America know that those who will live in these new government-financed houses will be exempt in whole or in part from their proportionate share of local taxation? These questions were asked by Mr. Tidings of Maryland on the floor of the United States Senate. They are not radical questions. They do not indicate that the senator is opposed to the social reform of slum clearance. They simply suggest that this slum clearance project proposes to adopt as wards of the state millions of citizens insofar as the government pays rent for them. And moreover, they indicate that there is little hope for those poor persons ever being gainfully employed because the government proposes to pay rent for them for the next 60 years. Oh, can America remain a democratic nation dedicated to private ownership, to private enterprise, and a private initiative, if to millions of its citizens there is proposed a policy of free rent, either in whole or in part? Because no economic reform, and by this I mean financial reform, because no economic reform preceded this laudable social proposal, because no financial or economic arrangement was evolved by which the dwellers in the slums could obtain work in private industry at a living wage, they will occupy new houses without the obligation of paying full rent. They'll be wards of the city, the state, and the federal government, for whom our gainfully employed citizens, or citizens engaged in less than living wages work, will pay taxes to liquidate the tax-exempt, interest-bearing, non-negotiable bonds which make this venture possible for only a few years to come. Oh, had the government instituted a sound financial reform when it passed the social reform of the Housing Act? Had the government issued tax-exempt, negotiable bonds predicated against the wealth of the nation? And had the government abandoned the capitalistic system of the private issuance of money together with the philosophy of the Federal Reserve Board, there would have been no necessity for imposing taxes upon the two-thirds of our citizens who are engaged in supporting the one-third in partially rent-free houses for the next 60 years. Senator Tidings continues to say, quotation, "Of course, the people of America do not know this. Indeed, it is my belief that many members of Congress do not know this. And that if both the people and the Congress would demand that the act be withdrawn and its entire philosophy changed," unquote. Mr. Tidings adds the following statement. "Let me resort to facts to prove my contention," says he, "to point out what is now going on in the United States Housing Authority. The United States Housing Authority was empowered to borrow $500 million in the name of the government, and then to lend this sum to states and cities of the United States for the purpose of tearing down unsafe and unsanitary houses and slums and rebuilding in their stead substantial, safe, and sanitary homes. The lowest income groups in any community to be given first preference in occupying these new quarters. So far, 141 apartment houses in 22 states of the nation, the District of Columbia, and the Hawaiian Islands have been contracted for and are being constructed under the United States Housing Authority. The total cost of these 141 apartment houses, which will provide living quarters for 64,431 families, will be $356,695,341, or an average cost per apartment house of $2,529,045. Now, this gives us an average cost of each unit in the apartment house of $5,520. According to another agency of our government, whose activities are wholly confined to insuring private homes, the average cost of the average American home lived in by the average American citizen today is $5,384. Thus, the slum families who will occupy the new apartment houses and built at government expense will live in apartments which cost $136 more than does the average house occupied by the average American family. Moreover, by the contract entered into between the United States Housing Authority and the cities of America, these new apartment houses supplanting the slums, and consequently the families that will live in them, are to be exempted in whole or in part from local taxation. But that's not all, continues the senator. The United States Housing Authority, and that means the government, has made contracts with each of the cities where this work is underway, providing that a part of the rent of each family residing in the apartment house is to be paid out of the Treasury of the United States. Let me repeat that sentence. The government has made contracts providing that a part of the rent of each family residing in these new apartment houses will be paid by the United States Treasury. These are all facts, and they are very salient facts. Let me refer further to the report issued on December 22, 1938, wherein the United States Housing Authority, referring to its contracts with the cities where the apartment houses are to be constructed, states that it has guaranteed to pay to these cities for a period of 60 years the sum of $15,864,364 each and every year. In exchange for this money, the municipalities are to be exempt in whole or in part from the government apartment houses of taxation. Further, the municipalities are to charge the occupants of these new apartment houses not rentals on the ordinary basis, which would retard the cost of constructing the apartment, but a rental far below the figure. Senator Tidings continues with this last observation. He says, note that the rents to be paid by the United States government over the 60-year period on these 141 projects will amount to $831,861,840. This is approximately 2.5 times the original cost of erecting these apartment houses. In other words, according to the contract the Housing Authority already made, and taking their own figures, the annual rent subsidies over a period of 60 years will take from the Federal Treasury 2.5 times as much as the apartment houses cost to build in the first place. My friends, I repeat, the trend in world affairs today is definitely away from capitalism. By capitalism, I do not mean the same philosophy of private ownership of private enterprise and the profit system. These principles existed long before capitalism was ever conceived. In this instance, I am more concerned with the philosophy of capitalism, which maintains that government should not participate in public works when necessary and in competition with private industry, and that government should not even be interested in issuing or controlling the value of money. I also include the industrial philosophy, which for the past century was identified with capitalism, namely the policy of paying men by the hour only when they worked. These abuses are part and parcel of our present economics, and I repeat, the trend is definitely away from them. It has often been said that this depression was man-made. In no wise can it be blamed on divine providence. It was not accompanied by a national drought or by the destruction of our factories. Oh, no. It was notable for the planned destruction of farm products, for the cessation of industry in a period when men were hungry and naked, and when citizens were most anxious to purchase the products of the factory. It was remarkable for abnormal inflation of debt money, over which only last week the Federal Reserve Board admitted it had no control. While the entire nation applauds Mr. Roosevelt and the New Deal government for their worthy objectives to institute social reform, does not the whole scheme appear to be doomed if these reforms are totally dependent upon finances which are still controlled by the Federal Reserve Bank, judging by the official statements which these institutions made? If we agree that the exploited, the underprivileged, and the unfortunates of the laboring class shall be housed, clothed, and fed, do we not also agree that under our present financial system, as evidenced by the figures which I read for you in the Housing Act, do we not also agree that this is being accomplished to the detriment of our entire social structure? There are more men unemployed and more families on the dole in 1939 than there were in 1936, despite our social reforms, because they were not preceded by or accompanied with economic reforms. This nation cannot sustain the principles of private propertyship if our social reforms are predicated upon such an unsound basis. The evidence of the past several years is eloquent in supporting this contention. Instead of achieving social reform, we will degenerate into socialism. Instead of preserving democracy, we will institute a species of totalitarianism. Instead of gaining prosperity, we will acquire a new standard of American livelihood calculated to lower us to the common denominator of poverty. One thing alone will be saved, and that is the sanctity of the economic system of capitalism with its financial, industrial, and agricultural abuses. The entire question of slum clearance becomes crystal clear when we ask ourselves, who are going to pay for these new apartments? If the occupants cannot pay the rent for them, the cost of their erection must be shared by the non-occupants through the process of taxation. Is it not logical to anticipate that year by year, thousands, nay millions, of those tax-paying citizens will find it more difficult to obtain employment
because industry finds it more difficult to sell its products when the purchasing power of the country, instead of being used to buy food and shelter and clothing, is being siphoned from the pay envelopes of our citizens to liquidate tax-exempt, interest-bearing, non-negotiable bonds. Therefore, I believe that I understand why Senator Tidings characterized our slum clearance program as socialistic and classified it as belonging to the Russian type. The intelligent senator understood that the social reform could not work satisfactorily under our present economic system. Nevertheless, whether it operates satisfactorily or not, a social reform is on its way. No political power can stem its advance. No propaganda can stifle its demand. A social reform is coming with socialism or without socialism, as you and I and the rest of us decide in the next few months. It will not avoid socialism or communism or Nazism or whatever you care to call it. It will avoid it only by our establishing a sound economic reform, which will preserve our best traditions and release us from the economics of internationalism. From the official data made available to Senator Tidings by the United States Housing Authority, we learn many more interesting facts corroborating the statement. Facts which concern the new apartments and their occupants who have been rescued from the slums. The figures covering the houses which were built before the Housing Authority was created show that the apartments were occupied by 13,210 families earning less than $1,800 a year, and that the average family earned not much more than $720 to $840 a year. Now, if an apartment costs $5,540, which is the average cost, how much rent would have to be received a year in order that the apartment could carry itself on the principle that a man should earn his bread by the sweat of his brow? I mean his own brow, not his neighbor's brow. In general real estate practice, one would have to get a return of 10%, which would have to be $554. If a 10% return is required of a man who is making $60 a month or $720 a year, how can he afford to pay on an apartment rent which amounts to $554 a year, which leaves him 50 cents a day to feed and clothe his wife and children? How can it be done? When the program of the United States Housing Authority is finally carried out, there will be 1,150,000 families in the United States who will be having a part of their rent paid each year for 60 years at the rate of $215 a family per year. One out of every 30 families in America will be living in houses built by the government and presented to municipalities free of any cost to them. These houses will cost more per family than the average American dwelling home. Now, in citing all these facts, I do not wish to create the impression that I am anxious to return to the old methods of capitalism. For more than 10 years, I've been pointing out its inequalities and iniquities. I'm just as reluctant to create the other impression that I'm anxious to subscribe to all the social reforms
similar to the slum clearance if these social reforms are planned and executed on the basis of the capitalistic financial system. For this, as I have shown, leads to socialism. There is a happy medium which is worth considering after several years of flagrant failure to get men back to work at a living annual wage and to distribute the produce of America for consumption. And the happy medium is this. Let us have social reform by all means. Christian social reform based on the principle that whatsoever we do to the least of Christ's little ones, we do unto him. Let the government undertake every social project in harmony with that principle. But in the name of common sense, let the government abandon the capitalistic economy of private bond issuance and the private control and regulation of money through which wealth is controlled and concentrated in the hands of a few, and through which these slums came into existence, so that the cost of its new social projects will not be priced with the tag of destruction. There is no need for America to follow the example either of Russia or of Germany. There's no need for us to erect a totalitarian state, to sacrifice democracy, to abandon private ownership, and to bid farewell to our political liberties as we reach out for social reforms. My friends, we are not in a dilemma. It's not a case of our being destroyed either by remaining as we are or by proceeding along Christian lines of social reform. Sooner or later, a majority of us will recognize that the time is opportune to cease borrowing ourselves out of the depression with tax-exempt, interest-bearing, non-negotiable bonds which have increased the depression. Sooner or later, we will abandon the pagan economics which deny men living wages, which force men into idleness, which rob the well-circumstanced citizens through the process of taxation, and which tend to reduce all of us to the same level of those nations against which we are inveighing so vigorously. Meanwhile, as I bring to your attention the distinction between social reform and economic reform, may I also stress the basic necessity for moral reform? Today, in many sectors of the world, religion is being persecuted out of existence and tyranny flourishes. It is also evident in our own country that many citizens have abandoned their early religious training and have adopted the policies of naturalism. My friend, naturalism, like capitalism, has run its course. If we entertain valid hopes for sound reform, I plead with you to revitalize all our activities, both individual and public, with the neglected principle of Christ, which is, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his justice, and all these things will be added unto you. I plead with you to sanctify your own soul and to be willing to accept this basic social doctrine of Christ as a foundation upon which every other social doctrine is built. I plead with you to adopt the principle that the lowliest laborer in our nation is our brother. From that point, let us begin to reconstruct the edifice of a sane civilization which will clothe the poor, house them and sustain them by fashioning an economic system which will permit them to earn their bread by the sweat of their brow. Naturalistic economic systems built upon the quicksands of individualism must must be abandoned. They lead inevitably to chaos, with its accompanying dissolution of democracy, prosperity, and religion. In conclusion, may I not only recommend the Catholic Charities Drive, now in progress in New York, but also the words of the Master from the 25th chapter of St. Matthew, where we read the following. I was hungry, and you gave me to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me to drink. I was a stranger, and you took me in. Naked, you covered me. Sick, you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to see me. Then shall the just answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see thee hungry and feed thee, thirsty and give thee drink? And when did we see thee a stranger and took thee in, or naked and covered thee? Or when did we see thee sick, or in prison, and came to thee? And the king answering shall say to them, Amen, I say to you, as long as you did it to one of the least of these my brethren, you did it to me. God bless you.
Father Coughlin's address is finished. In the remaining minutes at our disposal, Father Coughlin has a most important announcement to make to you. I simply ask, have you written your letter to your congressman about the neutrality bill? And now, once again, Father Coughlin.
My friends, the interest in Social Justice Magazine has grown tremendously during the past 2 months. More than 70,000 subscribers have been added to our list during that time. Keenly conscious of the events which have transpired in Europe this past week have a definite tendency towards a world war, and keenly interested in keeping America free from European entanglements, Social Justice Magazine, under my personal direction, is planning a program of definite propaganda to counteract a war-mongering campaign controlled by international disturbers to embroil us in this disaster. Our plan is this. We are arranging a nationwide contest for all school children enrolled in classes from the 5th to the 12th grades inclusive. We plan to interest every one of these children in all these grades to write a short essay on the general subjects of how best can we keep America out of war. In fact, I will be more correct in stating that there will be 8 contests running at the same time. Each child will compete against his or her classmates only. And a suitable subject will be selected for each class. Now, a total of approximately $16,000 in prizes will be awarded to the children of the United States, equitably apportioned to each class. This contest is for Catholic, Protestant, Jew, and Gentile, attending parochial, private, or public schools. Moreover, to engage the attention of you parents and teachers and all other adults, prizes running into the thousands of dollars will be awarded for the best essays which you will contribute, short essays, and essays to the point. This is a project of Social Justice Magazine under my own direction. Its main objective is to keep America out of war. Its main purpose is to build up
sentiment and propaganda against the warmonger. And its main hope is to interest every child in the nation to the extent that every child will become an advocate of no foreign entanglement. Next week's issue of Social Justice and the following week will carry further and full information. Meanwhile, may I thank publicly the many thousands of persons who make this publication possible, and particularly those thousands who courageously have volunteered to act as distributors in the cause of social justice, peace, Christianity, prosperity, and Americanism. Any responsible person in this audience is welcome to act as a distributor in his own city or neighborhood. Once more, encouraged by the success of the past few weeks, and looking forward to the success of thousands, yes, hundreds of thousands of children and parents and teachers interesting themselves in this grand national contest, 8 contests, in fact, at once, I appeal for another 5,000 responsible persons to act in the capacity of distributors at a profit for themselves. Please write to me directly at Royal Oak, Michigan, and I will mail you full particulars to act as a distributor. Boys and girls, parents and teachers, all between 5th grade grammar school and 12th grade inclusive high school, make up your minds now that you are going to be an entrant in this grand contest, competing against the boys and girls of your own class, competing for prizes ranging for each class of $1,000 first prize down to other lower prizes. All of you, boys and girls, parents and teachers, can enter this contest, can build up a spirit of propaganda, if you will, to keep America out of foreign entanglement. Meanwhile, parents, encourage your child to prepare to enter this nationwide contest, which will be outlined, I repeat, in the following issues of Social Justice. Your boy or girl may win $1,000, but above all, your boy or girl can play his part in keeping America at peace. That is all the more reason why persons already subscribing to Social Justice will desire to renew their subscription. I thank all of you for this generous, wholesome support which helps to make this broadcast possible. Good afternoon. God bless you. Write directly here to my office for full information and for a copy of the address to which you have listened this afternoon.
To become volunteers, to become a responsible distributors of Social Justice Magazine, as well as those of you who wish the address Social and Economic Reforms given by Father Coughlin this afternoon, write directly to Father Coughlin at Royal Oak, Michigan. Until next Sunday afternoon at this same hour, this is your announcer, Franklin Mitchell, bidding you good afternoon.
Ladies and gentlemen, we presented the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan. The thoughts and opinions contained in this address were entirely those of the speaker and in no way reflect the policies of this station. WHBI, Hoyt Brothers Incorporated, Newark, New Jersey.